start, as I've been told to do, with about 15 minutes introducing Jawaharlal Nehru to those of you who are not too familiar with him. I first became interested in him through my work on Mahatma Gandhi, because it was clear that Nehru was Gandhi's protege, it was Gandhi who brought him into Indian politics. And that was my sort of intellectual interest. But I have a more personal interest, because in my gap year between school and Cambridge, I was coming home in September of 1962, and they told us all to get to the old Palam Airport in Delhi very early, 3 hours, which was unheard of then. An hour was the normal time to board an international flight. And when I got there, they said casually to me, "You know you're travelling on the same plane as the Prime Minister." And Nehru and his entourage took up the first class of an ordinary Air India flight, and he was coming to London for a Commonwealth Prime Minister's conference. But as I shall say, it was only a few weeks before the Chinese invasion, and I think that tells you something about the lack of understanding of what was going on in Asia in Nehru's mind. But we'll come to that afterwards. His background and education, how he came to be India's first Prime Minister and also India's first Foreign Minister, because he combined the two roles. He was born into a Kashmiri family that had migrated into the plains of India and settled in Allahabad. The family was probably one of the wealthiest of Indian families. His father was a very prominent lawyer, particularly skilled in land law, and the old United Provinces was, of course, an area where there were large landed holdings and a lot of litigation, and therefore much money to be made by someone who was extremely skilled. The family mansion, Anand Bhavan in Allahabad, was beyond the wildest dreams of most people in India at the time. It had, I mean, several stories, huge grounds, a swimming pool, just amazing. But the money that was made by Nehru's father provided his beloved only son with a remarkable education. He had a private tutor until he was about 12. Then he was sent to this country to go to Harrow School, one of Britain's major public schools in London. And then from there he went to Trinity College, Cambridge, to study natural sciences and also read for the bar. He took the opportunity while in this country to travel a little bit when he was not about his studies. He returned home to India a fairly radical young man by the standards of the early part of the 20th century, and certainly more radical in his social and political attitudes than the most of the people in his family and his father. And it took some years for him to, as it were, find his feet in public life. He'd expected that he would become a lawyer, a practicing lawyer, working in his father's practice. But he found the conservatism and the sort of backslapping and the nature of the bar really was not at all enticing. And opportunity knocked at his door when Gandhi appeared on the Indian political scene back from South Africa and began to talk about non-cooperation, passive, peaceful resistance to the imperial regime. And really from about 1919, Nehru was scooped up into the world of Gandhian politics. He was never a Gandhian as such. He was, inasmuch as he supported the idea of non-violence, he was a pragmatist, when it worked, he was pleased to be non-violent. He thought it was a civilized and appropriate way of conducting oneself in domestic politics in the circumstances of India at the time. But he was a voracious reader, intellectually curious, and taught himself an immense amount about the world at large. I mean, he had no formal training in politics as such, no formal reading in the field of international relations. But he read, and he also travelled. Again, his father's money allowed the family to travel to Eastern Europe, to Western Europe, and, of course, to Britain. Sadly, also, his wife's ill health with TB meant that she had to spend considerable time in sanatoria in Switzerland and in Germany, and when he had to be with her, he would often take the opportunity to meet with interesting people in public life. So he was really a very serious but self-taught thinker, both in terms of politics and of government and also of international relations. But what he was utterly convinced about very quickly was that British rule had to be ended as quickly as possible, and that any new Indian state had to take up and deal with domestic issues which the British had never had the power to deal with, or the wish or the understanding that there were social and economic issues at stake which ought to be addressed. So the politics of nationalism was Nehru's induction into Indian public life. He became India's first Prime Minister in 1947 and remained in office until his death in 1964. He also became his own foreign minister. The Indian National Congress, the Congress Party, the main spokesman for nationalism, had very few other people who were really interested in the long-term issues relating to India's international stance and role. And Gandhi made it quite plain that it was Nehru he turned to in the 30s, particularly, and early 40s, on issues to do with foreign affairs. And Nehru built on his reading, his interests, his international connections, and became, from the 1940s, immensely well-travelled and well-connected. His social and his intellectual networks were, I think, far broader than most of those in Indian political life. It was perhaps one of his tragedies that there were no people, no interlocutors who could really stand with him and argue. And one of the people who had been able to do this, Vallabhai Patel, died in 1950, depriving India in the next decade of a really strong voice, somebody who could have questioned, challenged, sparked Nehru off to think different things, maybe. The other thing that was, of course, completely lacking when Nehru came to power was the sort of mechanics of international thinking, foreign policy making, intelligence, he had to start from scratch, really, building a foreign ministry. So, having told you a little bit about where he came from, I'd like to go on and think about some of the key tasks that faced him in 1947. And I put to you that he was one of the very first leaders of a country emerging as a new nation state out of an imperial situation, who had to think afresh and say, who are we? What is our role in the world? What could our role be? And how are we going to set about making this role happen? So one of the key tasks of somebody in his situation was first of all to think about the nature of the world, India's role within it, what would be the dominant ideas of a new foreign policy and so forth. Now that's not quite as fanciful as you might suggest, you might think, because the leaders of the USSR at the time assumed that India's foreign policy after 1947 would be in line with Britain's. They did not conceive that there could be a totally new beginning. Now, there are other tasks apart from thinking, which Nehru had to do. Creating the vision was certainly important, and I don't know whether you were able to circulate that little article, but it's very significant that when the Congress Party started looking seriously at the issues of foreign policy after independence, Nehru had to write this note, lengthy note, for the Congress president, Pathavi Sitaramaya, who was going to address the Congress on it. And of course, he used this almost word for word in his address. So thinking the vision, dreaming the dream, is one of the things that Nehru had to do. The second big task was actually creating a foreign service, where, of course, in the past, the conduct of foreign relations had been almost entirely in the hands of the imperial government. Where was Nehru to find the first generation of diplomats? Where was he to set up embassies? How was he to arrive at conventions for diplomatic behaviour? Well, they had to contrive methods for recruiting and examining the coming generation of diplomats, but the very first ones, Nehru plucked out of public life and out of the military as he could, as needs must. And I mean, he used a couple of very senior academics as his ambassadors to key places. Professor K. Panikkar, who was a well-known historian, for example, was sent to Beijing. Radhakrishnan, who became, of course, president, was at the time the Spalding professor here and a fellow of All Souls. He was summoned home to become a senior figure in the diplomatic service. Nehru also recruited his own sister, Vijayalakshmi, to be one of his ambassadors, and she spent time in London and then in Washington. So there is the issue of how you build up a cadre of people who are trained in the conduct of a country's diplomacy. And of course, not only conduct diplomacy, but form a pool of thinking about how diplomacy and international affairs should be managed. It's interesting that actually in this field, I mean, Nehru, as ever, was deeply intrusive and personal in his way of doing things. I mean, he even okayed what was to be the interior decor of the various embassies around the world. I mean, this is frankly crazy if you think that, you know, Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary are, you have really rather bigger things to think about. He was instrumental in saying what was going to be the formal dress of India's diplomats on big occasions when Western diplomats might be wearing, say, dinner jackets or even court dress in certain circles. He was also, of course, extremely careful to insist that his diplomats, when on official business, should be teetotal. No alcohol was to be served in India's embassies abroad. So this is all symptomatic of the trying to set up ways of doing things which would display India's values to a wider world as they met, as outsiders met India's diplomats. What's also interesting is that Nehru, as his own foreign secretary, was very keen on, as it were, face-to-face diplomacy. He travelled hugely. Much of his foreign travel was by air. He was the first generation of world leaders who regularly used air travel to conduct face-to-face meetings, to go to meetings, say, of the Commonwealth and so forth. And he forged personal contacts and built on older ones as he did this. He enjoyed this foreign travel. He enjoyed meeting people. He found it all stimulating. And he met people who could challenge him and who really sparked off his own thinking. So creating a foreign service, creating a style of doing diplomacy was perhaps the second big task that someone in his position had to do. The third thing, and here I tread delicately because I'm not a historian of intelligence, but he had to learn the hard way to think about how India would develop an intelligence capacity. These appear to have been extremely underdeveloped throughout his prime ministership, partly, I think, because of a result of a very thinly stretched diplomatic presence. There were no eyes and ears for India on the ground in many key places. So, for example, there was no Indian mission in Hungary at the point when the Soviet invasion of Hungary took place in 1956. And the only Indian diplomat within range had no secure telephone line to use to contact Delhi. Because of course, you know, the building up of a diplomatic presence around the world obviously took time as well as money. The other thing that appears to have been very difficult was, from our perspective, the lack of a modern technology of surveillance. It is clear that even after the Chinese invasion of India in 1962, Nehru's government had no idea of what Chinese military installations there were near the border. And one can ask oneself, I mean, how was surveillance conducted in the late 50s and early 60s? And of course, there were no satellites. Things had to be done by aerial reconnaissance and photography, and so you had to build up skill of people who could actually do that, and then could make the interpretation of what the photographs showed on the ground. And of course, the terrain of the borderlands between China and India made that sort of reconnaissance extremely difficult. So that, you know, the whole bundle of intelligence, from actual installations to understanding how other countries were thinking and making their foreign policies, was one of the very, very underdeveloped areas in Nehru's thinking and practice of foreign policy development. So there are three key tasks: dreaming the vision, creating a foreign service, developing intelligence networks. But But let's go to the most important one, I think, from the perspective of this seminar, and that look at some of the key themes in Nehru's outlook on India's place in the world. How are we doing for time? Are we okay?
Yes, we're okay.
Right, good. Do you want to stop at that point and give anybody a chance to ask questions?
Whatever you prefer. So
because in your instructions to me, you said that, you know, people might stop. I'm more than happy to stop and answer anything with that sort of more factual background.
I suppose. I wonder if this may link into what you're saying about this, the vision, dreaming the vision of India's place in the world, but I'm really interested as to what exactly he was reading, given that he's about, you know, he's a prolific reader and self-taught, and he's had a Trinity College Cambridge education.
Well, yeah, but you see, he read natural sciences.
Right.
So he did know of none of the academic reading that anybody coming to Oxford or Cambridge today would have expected if you were going to go into politics. Most of his really important formative reading was done in prison, because between 1921 and 1946, he spent very considerable periods of time in British prisons in India. Most of his jail terms, jail sentences, were in relatively comfortable surroundings. I mean, you know, he wasn't locked up with your common criminals. You know, I mean, political prisoners were given a certain amount of freedom. And one of the freedoms was being able to have friends and relatives bring in books. Mm. He very quickly ran through any of the most minimal prison libraries there were. You imagine they didn't really have many books at all. But I mean, the reading was quite incredibly eclectic. I mean, he read poetry, he read history, he read novels, and he read some actual sort of texts on government and on, you know, world history, but nothing really that we would say prepared someone for this sort of a role. If you go to the selected works of Nehru for the times when he was in prison, he kept a list of all the books he read.
Wow.
And it's very interesting. I mean, he was a voracious reader, enormously eclectic. I mean, I found, for example, that he read a book called Keeping Fit in Your 40s in jail. Obviously, he was feeling a bit creaky. And what is quite extraordinarily touching was when he was Prime Minister, he kept an eye on books that were being published, and he noticed that one had been published, I think, in Britain, called The Role of the Prime Minister. And he ordered it. He made his private secretary go and get a copy. And I think that suggests that he was very aware that he was, at one level, an amateur. Mm-hmm. And that he was building up his personal expertise and his personal knowledge at the same time as he was trying to construct a national expertise and pool of knowledge.
Regarding the sources of inspiration, I would like to know if he had some international political or intellectual figures he considers his inspiration.
Any people who were?
Yes.
I don't think so. I mean, he was obviously, I mean, you know, his the intellectual milieu in which he was comfortable in Britain and Europe was the Labour Party. But he was very aware that you couldn't lift European, British or any sort of socialism neat, as it were, and plonk it on India. You had to take ideas about justice, about national identity, about the redistribution of wealth, and see how it could be recreated within the Indian social context and economic context. He was deeply interested in what was going on in Russia, but was very aware that what he thought was undue coercion was part of the Soviet system, and that therefore the Soviet ideas, the construction of socialism, couldn't be lifted either. And he would always say, you know, that India had to find its own path, ideologically and practically. Perhaps it's time now for me to come on to some of the key themes in Nehru's outlook on India's place in the world. And I suppose the guiding theme for him was, of course, India's national security. That went without saying. And of course, that meant that one of the things that took up a lot of his time and his thinking was the relationship between India and Pakistan. I don't want to spend time on the detail of that, but I mean, though Nehru constantly said that he would like a peaceful resolution of the conflict that broke out immediately after independence, I think for him, for various reasons, Kashmir was a non-negotiable. I mean, some people say, well, it was because of his ancestry, but I think it was far deeper than that. For one thing, the Vale of Kashmir was a primarily Muslim area, and it was absolutely central to his vision of India domestically as a composite nation, that no part of India should think of leaving the Indian family, as it were, just on grounds of religious identity. So there was the sense that Kashmir was somehow a touchstone of Indian secularism, but also what he would call a composite nation, made up of many different communities who had found their home or made their home in India over centuries. He also was very aware of the importance of that part of India, given Chinese incursions into Tibet and the whole issue of the security of India's northern border. And it's interesting that whereas the British imperial regime had worried about the Russian bear, as they called it, on the northern frontier, for Nehru, the issue really was what was going on in Tibet and how that played off against relations with Pakistan and with China. So India's national security, first and foremost, but then ideologically, a hostility to both fascism and imperialism. And this was, of course, an inheritance from the nationalist ideology of the Indian National Congress, and also from his own personal commitment to forging an Indian brand of socialism. So he said, you know, that India would stand with any other nation that was hoping to escape from an imperial network, but it would also stand with victims of fascism. So those were the sorts of some of the bedrock ideas that he started with. I think one of the real problems in that was that he was so aware of the power and the spread of British imperialism that he couldn't quite get his head around the fact that a socialist state could be an imperial state. And it was Patel who warned him before he died in 1950 that he must be aware that both Russia and China were as capable of imperial designs as Britain or even America. Now, as he began to formulate India's practical stance, moving a little bit away from key ideas to the nitty-gritty, he was absolutely determined that India should play an upfront, public and important role in international affairs and organisations. And he was extremely aware of the growing importance of the United Nations. He also wanted not just to give India an international voice, but to give Asia an international voice. He had a very clear vision of Asia as a distinctive unit, incorporating what we would think of as China, Southeast Asia, and South Asia proper. And he believed that one of his roles was to help Asia find its voice, as he put it, in international affairs. Now, that led him to say, and to believe quite seriously and honestly, that one of his natural allies was China. Now, when China's nationalists were defeated by the communists, and China became a communist neighbour, he had to rethink what might be his stance. But he said, well, we think that China is a neighbour. It's got similar domestic problems to ours, and she is a natural ally. And none of the people who were his eyes and ears in China, particularly Panikkar, in this early stage, ever challenged that. So that, he really did maintain a vision of Indo-Chinese cooperation right up until about 1959, when it was clear that things were happening on the joint border, which really overturned that vision. Now, part of this commitment to international organisations was India's pivotal role in rethinking the nature of the British Commonwealth. And it's rather pleasing, actually, that we can talk about that this week, given that the reports that senior figures in the Commonwealth are beginning to discuss quite properly what will happen when the Queen dies and who will be the head of the Commonwealth, the figurehead. Now, when Congress was formulating its attitudes to the departure of the British in 1946-47, most people thought that India would immediately leave what was then called the British Empire Commonwealth. The dominant people with the dominant independent states within the Commonwealth were, of course, the former so-called white dominions, particularly Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. But the idea of India retaining dominion status was anathema to those politicians who were, and for a very long time, had been arguing for complete independence. Now, of course, the nature of dominion status had changed radically in the 1930s and 40s. And India and Pakistan both came to independence through a phase of dominion status in order to ease the general passage into independence. But it was assumed by most Indians and Indian politicians that when India reconstructed and created its own new constitution, it would become a republic and therefore would not be party to the Commonwealth. And, of course, that view was reinforced by the fact that that Ireland had left the Commonwealth. Anyway, what is so interesting is some of the people who were within Nehru's network were beginning to say to him in 46, 47, look, you know, we have very significant trade connections with Britain. We have very significant defence connections with Britain. We don't want to ditch those. And Attlee's government after the war in Britain was extremely anxious to keep India as part of the Commonwealth. And Nehru changed his stance on this and was one of the key people who rethought what the Commonwealth really was and came up with the formula that it was an association of countries with shared histories, shared ideals, and that the British Crown would be the symbol of free association. And on that ticket, India was able to stay within the Commonwealth when she became a republic. And it became, the Commonwealth became one of the great platforms on which Nehru projected himself in a wider world, and a stage on which he was able to use to very good effect, not just to listen to what other people were saying, but also to project what India hoped her place in the world would be. And then finally, and I suppose the thing for which Nehru is most remembered, was that he was absolutely committed to working for peace in an increasingly bipolar world. And it was for that reason that he really, I was going to say he developed, he developed this understanding of so-called non-alignment, of not aligning India with either of the major world powers, of working as far as possible with everybody who would cooperate with India. And he was one of the key, India was one of the key players in the development of the non-aligned movement, which drew in states from Asia and from Africa particularly. Now, this was not, I hasten to say, an absolute commitment to the idea of non-violence in international affairs. On the issue of non-violence, Nehru was always a pragmatist. He had been pragmatic when it came to the use of civil resistance, non-cooperation within India itself as a mode of opposition to the British. And in international affairs, he was quite clear that there might be times when organised violence, military force might have to be used. And he had no hesitation in 1962 of requesting military help from his Western allies. But I think, you know, the non-aligned movement was probably one of his most creative enterprises. Of course he was not alone in creating that, but it was something which he really hitched his name to. So I would suggest to you that we have in Nehru an immensely creative thinker about international affairs, somebody who rethought the way the world was, who was capable of challenging older ideas, whether about imperialism, whether about the Commonwealth, whether about alignment and non-alignment. But his, in practice, his vision was undermined so often by the aims of the larger powers and, of course, by India's dependence on them for food aid and for defence. In the longer term, I think his role and his importance in the 1950s was, ironically, because of the bipolar world, which he so hated. He was useful, incredibly useful, to the larger powers as they negotiated their way through the first decade after the war. And particularly, I think, to Western powers, to America and to Britain, he was very, very important because of their fear of communism in Asia. And it was one, I think, of the an American journalist who said that if Nehru hadn't existed, he would have had to have been invented because he was just so important as an intermediary, as the leader of a large subcontinent, which was not at all, apparently to them, going the way of China. So he was, he fitted into the world of his time as a person of great utility to other nations, to other nations' leaders. But I think in his own right, he was immensely creative as a thinker, and by default had to be creative in terms of India's own real needs as to create, you know, diplomats and so forth. That he had a constructive role to play, which would have had to have been done at the time. Now, I've strayed over an enormous amount of material. There'll be lots and lots of questions, I'm sure. And so please.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone. Can we...